First case for argument is Auchinleck versus LaGrange. Mr. Greenwald.
Good morning, Your Honors. We have here a case where the government has denied the plaintiff of a property right created by state law in violation of the 14th Amendment. We appeal from the order of the trial court, which entered an order of dismissal on the basis that Mr. Auchinleck, Chief Auchinleck, did not receive a wage. He was a mere volunteer. The rights of Robert Auchinleck to due process before action is taken against him were not considered insignificant or de minimis rights by the legislature of the state of Wisconsin or the governor of the state of Wisconsin. They considered these rights of due process that had to be afforded to police chiefs of towns, of villages, within the state of Wisconsin, so important that they created two very detailed statutes securing those rights. Contrary to the assertion of the defendant, we are here today over a violation which was not at the minimum.
Well, what kind of relief are you asking for?
We're asking that this court vacate.
No, I understand, but what is it you want to get out of this litigation?
What we want to get out of this litigation are damages, including damages for the attorney's fees.
Well, I don't have damages for attorney's fees. What damages do you have in mind?
The damages that I am referring to with respect to attorney's fees are not those attorney's fees for my services, but those of Attorney Patrick Hudick, which challenged the orders that were entered in this matter.
You mean the attorney's fees in the prior case?
No. No. My client incurred attorney's fees and $43,000 from the date that these orders were entered until the conclusion of the appeal from the certiorari that arose as a result of charges brought by the town alleging insubordination because of my client's refusal to accept those orders as valid orders. Those orders, in essence, stated that.
Now, why is this different from the attorney's fees in the prior cases?
Why is it different? It may not be different from the attorney's fees that Mr. Hudick charged my client in his prior cases.
And then you need to discuss, among other things, the problem of res judicata.
This case concerns actions that were taken in 1996, and specifically on October 11th of 1996 and November of 1996, I believe the date is November 29th, 1996. Prior actions concerned actions by the town of LaGrange before that. In fact, those prior actions were brought in 1994, 1995, long before the actions which are the subject of this suit even took place. The relationship of the prior suits to this suit is simply that 9 days after Judge Carlson said, you cannot take action against Mr. Auchinleck, against the chief, until he is afforded the rights that he is entitled to under the Wisconsin statute, including due process rights to the hearing before he is attempted to be terminated or his duties are attempted to be reduced or suspended in any fashion. 9 days, within 9 days of that direct order, they violated it by passing these ordinances.
So now where were the fees? I've lost the thread now. Where were the exact fees incurred?
In challenging those orders. Because in
Well, how is that different from this case? I'm lost.
Well, in having to challenge the order, he had to challenge the order because the order directed him to do certain actions with respect to turning over the records, etc., that he would not be required to do if he was the acting chief of police.
So it looks as if he's challenging his removal as acting chief, challenged it, incurred legal fees, lost, and is now again challenging. I don't get it.
And raising the same issues that were raised in the 1997 lawsuit filed in state court.
The 1997 lawsuit filed in state court was a certiorari proceeding from that proceeding which addressed the charges that were brought against him because he refused to comply with the order that
he was seeking in that certiorari proceeding.
What?
What relief was he seeking?
He was seeking the reversal of a finding by a hearing examiner that he was guilty of insubordination, and therefore the town and the punishment for that insubordination was permanent discharge.
So how is that different from this suit? The arguments are different, but the challenge is the same. You're challenging his removal from office for the second time. You've challenged it in state court, now in federal court.
Well, in state court, in the certiorari action, in this action, we're seeking damages on the basis of the violation of his civil rights under 1983,
yeah,
a remedy that is not available.
Counsel, that's just to say you're engaged in claim splitting, that you decided to file two suits over a single wrong. Things happen in 1996 that your client doesn't like, and that leads to two separate lawsuits. But that's normally just what gives rise to a claim of res judicata.
The lawsuits are separate.
Of course they're separate. That's why there's a res judicata problem.
The certiorari addresses the finding of insubordination. This lawsuit challenges and asserts that he was violated when he was placed on administrative leave before those proceedings were even begun. The certiorari did not address whether or not his rights for due process of law were violated when they placed him on administrative leave before they even brought charges of insubordination. That underlying lawsuit was whether or not he was guilty of insubordination. This lawsuit is whether or not, before they even brought charges, they violated his constitutional rights. I see my time is up.
Okay. Let me just ask you one question. Are
yes.
you still claiming here today that the positions were paid? The chief was actually paid, like, salary? Are you still taking that position?
Our position is that he was entitled to certain compensation benefits.
Right. But he did not receive, at
his own action, he chose not to make a claim for wages for the general administrative duties that he performed. When he was on patrol, when he was in training, etc., he sought and received compensation.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Mr. Mingo?
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. Mr. Auchinleck, at all times material to this litigation, was an unpaid, fully uncompensated, part-time volunteer chief for the town of LaGrange. It is the position of the town and the individual town board members who were also sued that Mr. Auchinleck's interest, whatever that may be, in a non-pecuniary position does not give rise to a property interest under the 14th Amendment, and therefore there can be no constitutional taking under the 14th Amendment. Mr. Auchinleck, in fact, that was the basis for Judge Randa's decision in the district court below. Mr. Auchinleck has challenged the decision on two grounds. Number one, he argues that he need not show any type of economic loss or economic detriment in order to have a 14th Amendment property interest. Secondly, he argues that even if he is required to establish some type of direct economic harm, he has done that by way of his own affidavit, which he submitted in this case. Mr. Auchinleck's initial contention that he derives a constitutionally protected property interest solely by way of some state statute is simply unsupported by the decisions of this court. Judge Randa was very clear in relying on two decisions, Ulitney and Bordelon. Ulitney was decided by this court less than a year ago, and in that case, we had a school principal who was demoted to what was essentially an administrative position without a hearing. She was unable to function as a school principal, but she received the same wage. There was no economic harm, if you will. The court in Ulitney found that one's mere desire, in that case, one's mere desire to perform the functions of a principal, or one's mere expectation to perform in that capacity, does not give rise to a protected property interest. And the reason underlying that rationale is that this court has recognized the severity that attaches when one loses his or her means of livelihood. The counter consideration is that this court has indicated it does not wish to trivialize the Constitution by finding a property interest where there is a lesser or de minimis type of harm. It's interesting that although Ulitney was decided less than a year ago and that it's the main basis for the district court's decision, the Ulitney case is not referenced anywhere in the briefs filed by the appellant in this case. The second case relied on by Judge Rand is the Bordelon case, again involving a principal who was demoted without a due process hearing. The pay was taken away, but equivalent sick pay was granted. Again, the court held that some type of economic loss is required, or at least some type of identifiable impact on one's future ability to earn before a property interest will be found. The last case I'd like to mention is the Swick case that was decided by this court. And Swick is important because Swick involved a police officer who was placed on involuntary sick leave with no due process hearing. And the argument was that somehow he had a property right to function as a police officer, which is basically the same claim made by the appellant in this case. And in Swift, the court held that one does not have a constitutional property right to wear a badge, make arrests, carry a gun, or otherwise function as a police officer. Given Ulitney and Swift and Bordelon, I think this court has made it clear that some type of economic harm does have to attach before a property interest exists, which is why, at least why I believe the plaintiffs have filed an affidavit, conclusory as it may be, but Mr. Auchinleck has filed an affidavit, which goes to Your Honor's last question, where he indicates that he was entitled to receive a wage and he does accept wages from the town. That statement is entirely false. It's untrue. It's unsupported by anything in the record. And Judge Randa acknowledged that when he indicates in a footnote that Mr. Auchinleck testified to the contrary in two depositions. He testified under oath that he never received a wage. The town board has never authorized payment of any kind to Mr. Auchinleck and has never made payment to Mr. Auchinleck for wages. The district court also noted that he has never filed a W-2 for compensation, never received insurance or other financial benefit. And additionally, the district court adopted the findings of the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, which held that Mr. Auchinleck at all times functioned solely as a volunteer. So that leaves the only potential economic impact, the attorney's fees, which were mentioned. And from our perspective, that is what is driving this lawsuit. It's not a concern over Mr. Auchinleck's constitutional rights. It's not a concern over his ability to function as police chief, because he was replaced in that office twice by the state courts. What's driving this litigation is a desire to collect attorney's fees. But clearly, attorney's fees is not the type of economic harm that this court has looked for in determining whether or not a property interest exists. If it did, certainly there were attorney's fees incurred in Ulipney, in Swift, in Bordelon, and I assume those fees were just as substantial as they are here. But attorney's fees have never been what this court has looked for in terms of economic harm sustained by an individual. And if we carry the appellant's argument to its logical conclusion, I assume that would mean that if Mr. Auchinleck appeared here pro se with the very same alleged harm, that he would not have a property interest because he was appearing pro se rather than having incurred attorney's fees. The incurring of attorney's fees is simply a result of the American rule of jurisprudence, and that is not something that is to be addressed under the 14th Amendment. So it's the position of the town and the individual board members that there simply exists no 14th Amendment property right, there has been no constitutional taking, and that the district court's dismissal of the entire lawsuit on that basis should be affirmed. Mr. Auchinleck also claims on appeal that he's entitled, or that he has been deprived of some type of a liberty interest under the 14th Amendment. First of all, as was noted in our briefs, a liberty interest was never pled. It was never developed by the appellant. And we can only assume that the liberty interest being claimed is Mr. Auchinleck's claim that he was entitled under the 14th Amendment to a liberty interest in his particular job, that is to function as a volunteer police chief for the town of LaGrange. This court has indicated time and time again that that is not the type of liberty interest that the 14th Amendment is concerned with. It is only where we have an individual who has been blacklisted, if you will, or where the governmental defendants have made it virtually impossible for that defendant to function in his chosen field that one can claim a liberty interest. And here the facts are that Mr. Auchinleck, at all times material to this litigation, had a full-time position at Motorola as an engineer. According to his own affidavit, he currently works as a paid instructor at Gateway Technical Institute, and he also serves as a part-time marine investigator. So Mr. Auchinleck can hardly claim on appeal that he was denied his right to function in his chosen field.
The assertion that because he was not paid a wage for his duties makes this a de minimis action is without support. I'd like to quote from this court's opinion in Thornton versus
Brown. Well, how far are you going to push this? I mean, what if someone was a volunteer docent at Brookfield Zoo, and would that person have a property right in that position? Is that your argument?
The statute is what creates the property right. The question is whether or not the violation of that property right is a de minimis violation because he did not receive wages. Here his rights to his employment.
What's the statutory provision on which you rely?
The property right is the property right to continued employment.
What is the statutory language on which you rely?
Two statutes, Your Honor, Wisconsin Statute Section 60.56.
What does it say?
It says that if a town board establishes a town police department under paragraph A, 1, or 2, and does not create a board of police commissioners, singly or in combination with another town or village, that the town may not suspend, reduce or remove any police chief or other law enforcement officer.
In other words, your argument is that the procedures create the property right.
That's correct.
Well,
are you
aware, counsel, that in 1987 we held an identical argument to be sanctionably frivolous as a matter of law, an automatic ground for award of sanctions to the other side? That particular argument, that procedures create a property right, has been raised and rejected repeatedly in the Supreme Court of the United States.
Okay.
I see no hint in your brief that any decision since 1987 in the Supreme Court has reversed Olam against Wakinakona or Hewitt against Helms, the decisions that cleanly rejected that line of argument. And therefore, I see no reason why this argument is not equally sanctionable. Is there some Supreme Court case after 1987 on which you're relying?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm not stating that the mere procedure alone is a right. I'm saying that the Wisconsin statute creates certain rights.
What is it in the statute? I mean, ordinarily, it's where you can't be removed without cause. Is that what the statute says?
Yes. Yes. And he can't, and no action can be taken, not only to remove, but to reduce or suspend without a hearing. And in that hearing,
yes,
that's there must
the
be
argument,
a...
That's the argument that was deemed sanctionably frivolous.
No,
that's just a repeat of it.
Well, if that was...
Are there criteria for...
But there's more. That's correct, Your Honor. And you can't do it without the cost. The two statutes work together. We, 60.56... Friend 1, Friend EM, and the statute on criteria, 62.13, Friend 5, Friend.
I just want to know, do you have any case that says that if you are in an unpaid position, you have a property right under the 14th Amendment? Any law from this circuit or the Supreme Court on point?
Well, there's no case on point, but close to it. Well, I think in... the United States Supreme Court decision, if I can just pick up
right,
citation. But there's United, you'll find it in the Dill case, which I cited in my brief, which says that two-week suspension from school for students, that there's no loss, is clearly beyond a de minimis violation and is actionable.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Greenwald. Thank you to both counsel.